history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some men and women around you who have some pretty incredible stories to tell, if we only take the time to ask and listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, along this journey, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The story we're going to hear today is pretty intriguing, from back in the World War II era and even in recent years, some adventures that Ed Larson has had. He is the author of a nice thick book called Spear Carrier in a Backwater War. And we're going to come to understand a little bit of what that means with 91-year-old Ed Larson of Santa Cruz, California, but originally from Seattle, Washington. What do you remember about those early years in Seattle? You grown up with basically a single mother and your grandparents?
A great place to grow up. Seattle was a wonderful town. It's changed tremendously, of course, through the years. But with the sound, Puget Sound around, the opportunity for boating and all that type of activity was just great. I loved the town, and a little disappointed in what's happened to it because of the freeway running through the middle of it now. It's kind of stolen some of the romance, but it's still a nice place, still a great place.
Maybe not as sunny as Santa Cruz.
No. Lots of rain. But that's when you live there, you get used to it. It doesn't bother you at all.
Sure. And it very famous for quite a long time in the aviation industry. But when you were growing up, what was it that first gave you that flying bug? Because that's what you would do in World War II, and you still had some adventures even in the last year in that regard. But what was it that first caught your eye?
My birth father was a pilot, and my mother related stories that he had told her. He left the scene when I was about a year old. I describe him as an itinerant saxophone player, tap dancer, and airplane pilot. He was a nice guy, but no sense of responsibility that was lasting at all. And he never changed in the course of his life. We remained friends, but we didn't see each other too often. But Boeing Field was kind of a mecca for me as I grew up. My grandparents and my mother used to take me down to Boeing's because I just loved the airplanes, and it was kind of a romantic place. There were a few military aircraft there then, and it was pretty primitive, but it was a great place to learn about flying. And the first time I ever flew, my dad took me up in an Aranca C-3, which I've described as kind of a cross between a tennis racket and a croquet mallet. It was a little dinky thing with a motorcycle engine in it. When my mother found out he'd taken me up, she went wild. But it was, I was hooked the minute I left the ground. My interest in aviation continued through elementary school. I illustrated a lot of airplanes, and I've been in art most of my life with a small amount of talent as far as drawing is concerned. I learned about the planes, and the affection kind of stuck through high school. And then when Pearl Harbor came along, there seemed to be only one logical place for me to be, and that would have been in the Air Force. I first tried to get into the Navy Air Force and made the mistake at the last instant of stating that I'd had some hay fever, and that threw me out of the Navy Air Force. So I went down the block and signed up for the Army Air Force and kept my mouth shut, which was a wise thing to do.
Same day, just right at one after the other?
I think there was about a day or two in between. But I remember the offices were only about two blocks apart. Yeah. So funny how things change fate, or how fate changes things, I guess I should more correctly put it. Your life is governed by those small decisions that you make.
Sure. And I'm sure there are a lot of those turning points to come in your story as we follow it along. I do want to ask you, I'd like to ask every veteran on this show this question, because everybody seems to remember something. You mentioned Pearl Harbor.
Right.
What about that day, December 7th of 41? Do you remember where you were and how you heard that news?
Absolutely. I remember it's like 9/11. Going back all of those years, it was Sunday, obviously, and my dad was working in the garage. I had an old 28 Chevrolet, which was my pride and joy, and I was washing it because I had a date with a girl in the afternoon for a tea dance downtown at the Olympic Hotel. It was a nice day, and my dad turned the radio on, and we were transfixed immediately. The news was just mind-boggling. From that day on, there was a spirit and a strength that grew almost hour, I'd describe it almost hour by hour, day by day, in the, throughout the whole nation. And the dedication of guys wanting to get involved, wanting to pay the Japanese back for what they'd done, was just an overwhelming factor. All our lives were changed that day. And Seattle being on the coast and being on Puget Sound, there were a lot of rumors around that the Japanese were off the west coast of the United States with their carriers and all this. Well, of course, it was all baloney. But along with the mobilization of people going into the service, there was also a tremendous increase in a hurry-up manufacturing effort that, of course, spelled doom for Germany and Japan eventually. I can remember Boeing Field, my little old place where I was interested in light planes. Pretty soon you would see early fighters there, and the Boeing Aircraft Company immediately burgeoned into a huge, huge complex. It was a historical time, and it was a time of romance and adventure. And sadness, total sadness, of course, as the word came back that from kids that were going, particularly the South Pacific, that were involved in the early battles there, and we lost, what, 3,000 at Pearl Harbor. It was a difficult time. The Depression's downturn. There was a generation of strength, as I said before, that began to build in the people, and the Depression wasn't the problem that it had appeared before. The war now was primary. So a shift in concentration, a shift in optimism, a shift in determination all came in to supplant that feeling of desperation and everything that characterized the Depression. Which was a tough time. I can remember my grandmother feeding people that would come by the house asking for food for work, and she always fed them on the back porch where they wouldn't be embarrassed. Mm. I used to think maybe there was a check on the gate at our front door that told them that this was an easy place to eat because we had a lot of guys, young guys, middle-aged guys coming by for a handout. Mm. And that stopped because pretty soon, there was a job for everybody,
yeah,
men and women.
And overall, a big job that was in front of all of you. And so you're just 17 years old. You haven't finished high school. And your mom lets you sign up for the Army?
Yes, yes. My dad and my mother had remarried by that time. And my father, as I said, he was the superintendent of a salmon cannery in southeastern Alaska. And they both agreed that maybe that was the thing to do. You always have to question their motives. I don't know whether they figured that might be a way to get rid of me or not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just kidding. Because
temporarily or permanently?
No, temporarily or permanently, yeah.
And you went into the Army Air Corps with the idea that you're going to be a fighter pilot.
That's exactly what I wanted to do. Yeah, it was. I built model airplanes. I drew model airplanes. I read everything, G8 and his Flying Aces in the magazines and books of the time. And flying was really a total obsession with me.
Was there a pilot out there who was kind of the hero or role model for you?
Oh, there were lots of them. The racing pilots of the late 30s, Roscoe Turner and so many, Benny Howard, Howard Hughes, and the airplanes that they were flying were gorgeous, creations. The aircraft that were built in the late 30s and early 40s, including the military aircraft like the Boeing F-4B-4 double biplane, the early Curtis Hawks, they were just items of beauty. And of course, some of the aircraft during the war achieved that status too, the B-51 Mustang and the Focke Wulf 190.
Yeah.
They were magnificent aircraft.
Well, and you would be around quite a few aircraft, but tell me about that journey. And in your hopes of being a fighter pilot, you got to test out in some of those single-engine planes, right?
Yes. I never flew any fighters, but I ended up as an instructor, a single-engine instructor, after I graduated in April of 1944. I was assigned to a field in Taft, California, as an instructor in basic flight training, and they were just switching over then to the T-6 Texan North American. It was a lovely airplane. It was a lovely airplane to see. It was a lovely airplane to fly, fully aerobatic, lots of power, and it was just short of being a fighter of the North American type. And I loved the airplane. I'd flown BTs, basic trainers, before, and they were a little logy and a little slower, but didn't have the spunk that the T-6 had. And there are thousands upon thousands of guys who flew that airplane, not only in training, but as instructors, that remember it with a great deal of kindness, even though they went on later to fly late P-40s, P-51s, and P-47s.
And it sounds like you're saying you would have been content to just stay there in Taft and keep training pilots in the T-6.
Yeah, I would have been. It was a great job. But they nipped, I think there were 13 of us that were kind of Peck's bad boys, so to speak, and they shipped us out to Kirtland Field in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to B-24 school. They needed four-engine pilots at the time, so we were picked, unfortunately. I wanted to get into fighters, but I never made it. From Albuquerque, after we finished our transition there, we moved to Greensboro, North Carolina, to an overseas replacement depot, then down to Miami, Florida, and then we were flown to Natal, Brazil, by Pan American Airways and C-54s, and we waited there for overseas flights to India and the Middle East. We flew from Natal, we flew in C-87s, which were B-24s, converted from bomber configuration to transports. We hopped from Natal to Ascension Island, and from Ascension Island to Accra, Africa. We had to make the stop because we didn't have enough gas to get all the way.
Sure.
And then we hopped, skipped, and jumped all the way across North Africa to Aden and the Red Sea, and on up to India, to a place called Tezcon in the Assam Valley. That's where we ended up, and we were supposed to remain there as C-109 pilots. Now, C-109 was a B-24 that was reconfigured to haul gasoline. They took the four bomb bay guts, so to speak, out of the airplane and filled those with collapsible tanks. And the idea was to fly aviation fuel from the Assam Valley in India to China over the hump. Mm-hmm. And the hump, of course, was romanticized, as it should have been. But in order to qualify these statements that I make, I made only one trip over the hump in what they called the Able route, the north route, which was the heaviest, the highest, and the worst of the routes. The rest of the times I flew the hump were in routes that were labeled B and C, and they moved progressively farther south as they ran the Japanese fighters out of Burma and that area. We could fly farther south, fly lower, mm-hmm. and the terrain wasn't quite as bad. It was still no walk in the park.
Well, and for those who are uninitiated to this lexicon, when you say the hump, you're talking about the highest mountain range in the world, the
yes.
Himalayas.
Yeah.
So that A route was the highest altitude, yeah. or at least the most, the closest to the peaks, those
right.
rocky crags, and those others were lower altitude. And some people don't even realize that the war was going on in this part of the world. We hear so much about Europe and the Pacific, but people forget about the CBI, China, Burma, India, right, which is where you were.
Right.
Have you ever gotten some funny looks from people when you tell them where you served?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of them, of course, in this day and age, if I talk to kids, they don't know there was a war in China. In fact, they're barely aware, many of them, that there was a war of that extent going on at all. And I can understand that. That war was 70 years ago.
Very true.
Time passes and things impact, and the effect of Iraq and Iran and 9/11 and all have oriented the kids toward different wars and different times, as it should be, as it should be. It's wonderful to be remembered for having been where I was when I was there. I love that. But those times are gone. There were times of romance. There were times of tremendous adventure, of heavy sadness. Lost a lot of friends.
Because the work you did was at times quite dangerous. We're going to hear more about it when we come back from our first break. You can find photos of Ted and info about his book online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 91-year-old Ed Larson of Santa Cruz, California, originally from Seattle, Washington. If you grew up in Sacramento, perhaps he was your art teacher, and he's helping teach a lot of folks about the China-Burma-India theater of World War II through his book, Spear Carrier in a Backwater War. If you'd like to order it, I have a link for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Ed's dream was to be a fighter pilot, but instead, he was part of a vital lifeline providing fuel to the fighters, delivering it from India to China by flying over the Himalayas in C-46s, as well as C-109s, which were B-24s converted to carry fuel instead of bombs. Ed, what was it that made what you were doing so dangerous?
We never had any fighter opposition. Our enemy was the weather, and the fact that the terrain was so bad and the radio facilities were so primitive that you're pretty much on your own, so to speak. I mean, when you started out from India to fly to China, you were in bad weather probably most of the way, and we only had dead reckoning navigation. You flew out your time, figuring that what the winds were being reported, and then you let down. And hopefully everything was okay. But if the headwinds were up, you might let down into a mountain somewhere, which happened a lot.
Well, I've talked to some guys who flew that route, and they've told me about the aluminum highway.
Yes.
Why don't you explain to us what that was? It's not very encouraging.
No, it was a place where a lot of aircraft were lost, mainly because of weather. But I give all kinds of credit to the guys that were there at the first, before my time, because they were flying C-47s and B-24s that were really not capable of getting all that much altitude to spare. They were primitive aircraft, the C-47s in particular, and it amounted to a time of cliff dodging, and that was tough. And as a result of that, a lot of airplanes are down there, and a lot of them that I don't think have ever been found. I'm sure of that.
Well, and that's where that term, the aluminum highway, came from, all the wreckage They said you could even navigate your way across the Himalayas based on the wreckage, which is, I mean, the cost of that in human lives is pricey. With regard to your specific missions there, these C-109s, you're loaded with aviation fuel.
Right.
Now, you said you never faced fighter opposition. Good thing, because, I mean, they could have made you a big old bomb, right?
Oh, yeah. If we'd had any fighter opposition down there at all, we'd have been toast, because none of the aircraft that we had had any guns or any kind of defense mechanism. Most of the flying I did over there was in C-46 Commandos, which was a huge largest twin-engine aircraft in the world at the time of the war. It was a good airplane that carried a heavy load. It looked like a big whale. It was an ugly airplane. But with the advent of what they call the R2800 engine, which was a huge Pratt & Whitney engine producing a little over 2,000 horse, we had 4,000 horsepower aircraft there, and we could carry good loads. It was a dependable airplane and pretty forgiving. Most of our flying was from areas, gas drops like Kunming, Yunnanyi, Luoyang, places like that. We would pick up the fuel locally there and then fly it often, always, of course, in C-46s in 50-gallon drums, and dump it off at the fighter strips along with the bombs and ammo that we carried. And that's what kept them going.
So when we see the old footage or the still photographs of the P-40s with the shark teeth on the nose,
right,
the flying in China, they wouldn't have been flying without the fuel you brought them.
That's right. Yeah, we kept them aloft. The P-40, of course, was the hallmark aircraft of the CBI because of the fact that it flew there when Chenault was there, and those were early 40s. They were
right.
They were
long before you got there.
Oh, yeah. But the P-40 lasted till the end of the war. I think the last model was an N model that was quite an airplane. Most of the fighter aircraft over there that were being used were P-51s.
Sure.
Some P-47s, but they used so much fuel that the P-47 used a lot of gas, and the 51 was therefore more practical.
I want to talk to you about some of the hazards that you faced. You mentioned the weather was your opposition, was your enemy, but while we're on the topic of those fighter planes, when you would deliver this gas over there to China where the fighters are going to be using it, did you ever try to talk your way into a joyride in one of those fighters, one of those hot pilots?
This is a story that I brought out in the book. There were three abandoned P-40s on the strip at Yunnanyi when we got over there, and we were flying, like I say, the C-46s. Several of us got together and thought, hey, maybe we can get one of these into flyable condition so that, you know, we could get a little P-40 time on our logbooks and say that we at least had flown a fighter. So we tackled one that was particularly in fairly good shape. We had a crew chief that was from a fighter unit that was adjacent to us there at Yunnanyi. He helped us out some and figured that it was practical for us to go ahead. But some of the parts we couldn't get a hold of, and we wanted to get the okay of our CO to let us go ahead with a project which had been kind of under wraps up until that time. So my buddy and I went in and presented our plan to our CO, and he blew his stack. He said, yeah, this is a war zone. You guys are supposed to be flying transports. You're not going to go out and kill yourself in these P-40s, so just forget it. And that's what stopped us there. But it was a near miss. We were getting close to being able to get one started up and get it going.
So if you had decided to ask forgiveness instead of permission, you might have gotten away with it, huh?
Well, if we'd asked forgiveness, we might have busted our necks, too, because within about, 2 months, they did refurbish the old trio of 40s that were there, and they all crashed.
Wow.
Guys wanted to fly them because they were AVG. They were Flying Tiger P-40s.
American Volunteer Group, right?
Yeah. And nobody was killed or badly injured, but they just quit, you know, and they ended up in a rice paddy somewhere with a mark on their forehead from hitting a gun sight or something.
So maybe the CO was right and discretion was the better part of valor there.
He was absolutely right.
So on these missions, and maybe I should go right here with the title of your book, spear carrier in a backwater war. What does that mean? Explain how you came up with that title and what it represents.
Okay, yeah, in the legitimate theater, a spear carrier is a person that's in a play that is nothing much more than just a backdrop. It'd be the people in a crowd. It would be someone eating in a restaurant or something that didn't have a speaking part, that didn't really have any effect on the outcome of the plot or what happened to the stars. And so the name always stuck with me. Spear carrier was being kind of not exactly a loser, but a person that really didn't have a very important job to do. So I thought, hey, spear carrier in a backwater war was a fairly logical title, because that's what we were. We were carrying stuff to guys that were flying hot airplanes and enjoying the romance and the adventure of being fighter pilots and out on search and destroy missions. A very close friend of mine was shot down close to the end of the war. He just passed away recently. Great guy, great pilot. And he loved what he was doing over there. He got shot down while he was trying to drop a 500-pound bomb on a string of Japanese landing craft. They got a lucky hit on him, and he was shot down, but he got out and was back in at the field in about a month. Mm. The Chinese got him safely through the area and back to his field.
So all of that seemed real exciting to you, but your view of your own duties and contribution, what you're saying with that title is, I wasn't that important. But the reality is, as I know you recognize, that those guys couldn't do what they were doing without what you guys were doing.
And that's true. And we took a lot of chances. We were landing on fighter strips. We lost two airplanes at a little place called Chikiang, which I should also mention before we're finished. They just ran off the end of the runway because the strip was too short. We flew in bad weather. We flew in rotten field conditions. We flew when we really didn't want to fly. So it wasn't, you know, I don't negate my part in the war, but it wasn't the adventure and zip that most of the pilots that were there enjoyed.
Sure. Well, then I think it's important that he wrote a book like this, because it can help us understand the things we don't hear about all the time. Because everyone's heard about fighter pilots and some of the big battles and prisoners of war and all these things that are so easy to spot and easy to gravitate towards. And it's easy to forget about all the guys who are just doing their job like you were over there.
Yeah, and it's really important that they be remembered. Close to the end of the war, I lost five friends in one crash. It was a heavy load for me to carry. I came out of the war with it's a little bit difficult to explain precisely what it was. I guess an ongoing depression and a strong feeling of guilt that I should have been on the flight, which I should have been, but I had been diverted to go do something else. It's easy for me to understand the crisis that some of these young kids are going through now, coming home from Afghanistan and Iraq. And I feel for them. I feel very strongly that they need all the help that they can get to make their recovery, because it's not easy. And I felt that way for several years afterwards. It was a tough thing to break through.
I'm glad you brought that up, because we see and we're so moved by the physical wounds that are so obvious.
Oh, yes.
Guys who lose an eye or an arm or a leg or any kind of physical wound, but the emotional and the mental wounds are significant and lasting and heavy, and that's what you're talking about. I don't want to push you to go anywhere you don't want to go, but can you help us understand what that crash was and why you were supposed to be with them?
Yeah, it was, I don't know what the main cause of the crash was. I've never been able to understand that. But I had been assigned to fly with one pilot who had requested me as the co-pilot. I was flying co-pilot at the time. The flight roster just came up that I was assigned to a flight going out to Shanghai just after the war was over. And this crash happened after the war was over. Mm. Anyhow, we flew out to Shanghai, dropped a load of stuff off, then came back to our base. It was close to where we are. We were flying out at Luoyang at the time, and this was a place called Kunming, with the name of which many of your listeners will recognize.
Sure.
We were about ready to take off from Kunming and fly back to Luoyang when we were told to stand by because they had another assignment for us. We waited and waited, and finally we were told that we were to fly a load of Chinese generals from Kunming to a fighter strip called Chikiang. a field that I'd been into often and flown into a lot. The thing that had happened was that this was a primary assembly of Japanese and Chinese leaders to establish the primary factors that would govern the surrender of Japan and China. So we loaded these generals up in the 46 and flew to Chekiang. Got in there fairly early and realized finally that, hey, this was a big show. It was supposedly to have taken place in a field close to Nanking, an easy journey for the Japanese and an easy journey for the Americans, or for the Chinese to meet. But some B-25s had come in and leveled the airfield that was supposed to be the place of the surrender, so they had to move it to Chekiang. What happened was that we were a bunch of, as I say, you know, mud cake guys that were from the backwater war, and here we were going to be dropped down at the ceremony that dictated the surrender of Japan to China. It was really exciting. We flew in there 10:30 in the morning, and the meeting was to be in the afternoon. About, I guess, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, we heard this strange engine noise coming over the hills from the east, and it was a Betty bomber, which was one of our main concerns as far as the Japanese bomber was concerned. It's a good airplane. It flew in. It had huge white crosses on it. They landed, bounced a couple of times, which pleased us a great deal, and then taxied up to a hard stand, and about, oh, I guess 8 or 10 guys got out of that airplane and stood around, and everybody was, of course, staring at them, and this was something that, hey, here's the enemy 10 feet from where we were standing. It was close quarters. What they had done was they had taken a bunch of, like, picnic tables and put them out in a line, covered them with sheets to form a kind of a little dignity in this muddy fighter strip for the surrender to take place, because it was all kind of just off the top of their heads. And then following the Betty by about half an hour, a plane that we called Topsy, a twin-engine transport, flew in. It was gorgeous. The camouflage job on the airplane was absolutely beautiful. I likened it to one of those exotic toads that would have maybe white, red, yellow, green, predominantly dark green. That was the camouflage pattern they used. The airplane landed perfectly, taxied up beside the Betty bomber. Three Japanese top commanders climbed down, complete with their impeccable uniforms, impeccable samurai swords. The airplane absolutely gleamed. Everything about it was clean, perfect. And here, sitting amongst these C-46s and P-51s that have been operational, and they're all dirty, the wheels are caked with mud and all that. So it stood out. I say in there, she was the star of the show. It was a beautiful airplane anyhow. To make the long story short, they went ahead with the ceremony, and we were privy to be right there at the signing of the papers, etc. To get back to the crash, I had been regularly scheduled to fly with this kid that was flying first pilot. Because I had been assigned to take this Shanghai trip and was delayed, I didn't get back in time. And five of my friends, one of whom was a buddy that was involved with me in the P-40 caper that we were going to pull off, they were all killed. Mm. And the airplane crashed about 20 miles from Kunming, which was a pretty decent airport at the time. It had lights and all that. I don't know what happened, but I carried the survivor guilt of that. And I don't, you know, it's easy to say, hey, it wasn't your fault. You shouldn't have been there. You were in Shanghai. You were doing what you were told to do. It's fine to say that. And it's fine probably to say to some of these kids, well, you're going to be fine and all that. You don't get past it.
It doesn't make it better.
It doesn't make it better. And there's times today, 70 years after the fact, that there's still that little grab, maybe in a dream, or that thing wasn't right. That's just the way I feel, and that's what enables me, and I'm very grateful to have some commiseration for these kids that are suffering physically and mentally at this point in time.
And I don't want to rub salt in any of those wounds. I just want to, again, understand it and make sure our listeners understand.
Of course, of course. No, I think you've handled it very gracefully, and I've done the best I could to hang together.
Well, and part of that implication, I mean, these are five guys that you knew, that you'd flown with.
Yeah.
You said one of them was even in on that P-40 idea with you.
Right.
You would have been on the plane, and one of the guys was in the position that you would have had. So, in other words, you probably felt like somebody died in your place.
Exactly. That was my feeling, you know, because when you commit to a partnership, you kind of assign a permanence to... there were several guys that I flew with regularly, but this time, it was just this one kid at this particular point in time. There was a closeness there and a feeling that you could depend on one another. He knew what I could do in the right seat. I knew what he could do in the left seat. Oft times, we just switched. One was flying pilot, one was flying co-pilot. Survivor's guilt is something that you don't get over in a week. Or a month.
Well, and that was my question, and you made it clear that it did weigh on you for quite a while affected your life after you got back from the war.
Oh, desperately, yeah. Definitely.
Was there something that eventually did help you deal with it or move past it in a way?
Yeah, I'm sure there was. It was the fact that time passed, that I began to move a little bit away from the immediate remembrance of what had happened. The flight log was a little bit hazier, and time had made things, it was like putting a little bit of salve on a wound. And then I married, and my wife knew how I felt, and a wonderful, incredible woman that I lived with for 63 years that understood the problem and helped me through it.
While we're on the topic of that, your wife's a World War II veteran, too. She was in the Wave?
Yes, absolutely.
How'd you two meet?
We met in Seattle after the war. She also spent a year in Japan. She went over to work on MacArthur's staff as a secretary. And so she spent a year in Tokyo after the war. And then when she came home from Tokyo, we were married. She was a little unusual, too, in the fact that she went overseas as a Wave. That usually didn't happen.
Yeah, most of them serve stateside.
Exactly. And she was in Oklahoma working on a drone program, interestingly enough, in 1943 and 44. And then the situation had been so bad out there that they took the girls that had been out there and sent them to Hawaii for duty in Oahu. And she did a lot of flying over there as a passenger because she was a courier and worked right under the admiral staff.
Quite a story that she had.
Oh, yeah. So. Yeah. She was quite a person.
And you'll find a photo of Marilyn in her World War II Waves uniform in Ed's book, which he dedicated to her. All that information is at hometownheroesradio.com. When we come back, how something Ed wore in World War II saw action in a more recent war, and the adventure he had just in the last year that he calls one of the best experiences of his life. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV. It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com.
honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 91-year-old artist, author, and World War II veteran Ed Larson of Santa Cruz, California. For a video of Ed with a couple examples of his artwork, check out the Hometown Heroes radio page on Facebook. He flew over the hump, the Himalayas, during World War II, ferrying fuel from India to China. And Ed, you made reference to the weather being your enemy. Were there occasions where you weren't quite sure you were going to make it?
Yeah, I had a few close scrapes in weather. It's hard to define them specifically right at this point in time. But we'd have the radio procedures that we use were unimaginable today. We didn't have GPS. Just at the end of the war, they brought out a thing that they called Loran, which was miraculous, but we didn't know how to use it. They even had the Loran sets on the airplanes, but nobody had been trained in how to use it. And I don't know that it would have been that good at that point in time. But little things happened. I guess one thing I mentioned in the book, this buddy of mine and I were flying, I can't remember where we were taking this load. Anyhow, it was a C-46, and we were at Luliang. It was a good long strip and everything. And so we started to take off, and something didn't feel right about the airplane. I was flying pilot. He was flying co-pilot. We mentioned this thing is Logie or something like that. And we kept going and kept going, and we couldn't get her off. The runway, the end was coming up. I think it was a loading factor that had been loaded a little bit, maybe tail heavy or something. Anyhow, the last I remember is hollering, gear up. And before we were quite flying, but she held up long enough so that I could see, as I saw a huge pile of cement go by just under the left-hand gear as it was coming up. So it was that close. And it took us forever to climb to altitude. And we complained about the airplane when we got back. They ran a check on it, and both props and engines would run to max, which we needed. They figured it was probably some kind of a loading error. But little intrinsic things that happened, airplane accidents are always a chain of events. They go from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's very seldom one cataclysmic thing. It's something that you forgot to turn a valve, or you turn the valve only halfway and all of a sudden your engine cuts out on takeoff, or you forget to roll your trim tabs back. I lost a friend from that. And it's just little items, that the minuscule physical things that you do to take care of an airplane, you slip up, and that one thing leads to something else, leads to something else, leads to disaster. So
one, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like in that story that you just told, that if you had waited a split second longer to get the landing gear up, they would have hit something and you might have tumbled and
it'd have been a mess. Yeah, believe me. And I, you know, you romanticize these things to a certain extent through the years, but I can still remember I had the throttle jammed. It's a wonder I didn't bend them. And we were both just trembling on the seat, and I can remember I did it just while we were talking, looking out that side window and just seeing that thing flash past. And I thought, God, we made it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever count up all the missions you flew over there?
I didn't, because it wasn't that kind of an operation like in England, where you'd go across a channel, you know, 50 times or 26 times or something like that, and then your gig was due. It wasn't like that. We just, we wanted to fly a lot more than we did, but the airplanes weren't available and the missions weren't there. It wasn't a situation where they sent you home after you had 25 flights.
Sure.
Because I had a lot more than 25 flights.
What'd you do when you came home from the war?
There again, I was kind of screwed up. Didn't know what to do. When you're in a group like the one I was in, or anybody, I'm sure you've heard of that or seen that movie Band of Brothers. Your home life and the family that you left are supplanted by the guys that you went to war with. I know it sounds crazy, but it's the truth. And it was that way with me. I was uncomfortable at home. In fact, I took one leave right after I graduated from flight school, and I went back to the field 3 days early. Not it was because of my family being weird or anything. It was just that I wasn't comfortable. The guys that I knew and had spent a year and a half with in close contact, doing a lot of things we loved and enjoyed, I wasn't comfortable when I came home from the war. I didn't know I had this problem, this mental situation that I'm talking about. I was uneasy. I was anxious. I drank too much. I started school, couldn't apply myself. It took me a long time to get it together. And then gradually, after I was married, I started in, got a regular job, and moved on up the ladder, so to speak. Went back to college, graduated with a good grade point, went into education, which was a wonderful thing for me, and that was it. I was an art major. That's why I referenced drawing airplanes all my life. I always had a drawing talent. So I was with the school district for 23 years.
In Sacramento?
Yeah, mm-hmm. San Juan School District. Yeah.
Maybe some of your former students are listening right now.
They could be. They could be. I loved it. I loved teaching. I went into administration, but I still maintain a really close association with the classroom because I like the teaching better than I like the administration.
I've heard that before.
Yeah.
Do you still draw?
Not very well. My eyes, as I say, have gotten so bad that that's one of the things that I really miss because my art was at a professional level. I did a lot of illustrations in the book there, some of which were done after my eyesight began to fail. But, there's still recognizable, and I enjoyed doing them.
That's when you become an unintentional impressionist, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the less accuracy, the better. Yeah, well put.
I see some of your drawings right here, and I'll put some photos up at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Also, a link there to where you can buy Ed's book, which you're going to get almost 500 pages worth here. It's very lengthy. What made you want to write this book? Did somebody have to twist your arm?
Yeah, they did. People kept asking me why particularly because the war over there wasn't very well known. I sent home voluminous letters to my mother and my grandmother during the course of the war. And when the years went by, my mother had saved everyone, tied them up with ribbon and put them in a cardboard box. That was one of my chief resources, because I could go back and read all the letters that I had, not only from the States, but overseas. And although a lot of it was censored, it triggered a lot of memories that made it easier for me to write the book.
Is there a part of this book that, as you look back, once you completed it and read through it yourself, that you're really proud of, or maybe you've gotten the most positive feedback on?
There are a few passages in the book that I was really pleased with. One, just one comes to mind right now. I tell a story about 1940 at the beginning of the war. I wrote a story about some people being out in East Anglia on a cliff, looking out across the English Channel toward France. The little village there had been peaceful for so long. As they stood there, three Hawker hurricanes had been on a sweep across the channel and were coming back toward England. And these people were out close to the end of the cliff when these three hurricanes came over the top of them at about probably 20 to 30 feet. Three of them just roaring flat out, and the effect that it had on the people, and it was an intrusion of noise and speed and drama that changed a quiet morning on the coast into a raging hell of noise for a few seconds, and that's what happens, you know.
Kind of a microcosm of the greater picture.
Yeah. I hate to say it, but I like the way I wrote it, yeah.
Well, good. You should. One thing I've noticed about this book, it appears to mix your first-person narrative and the things that you witnessed firsthand with the broader picture of the war and putting it in context of what's going on globally.
I tried to time it so that what I was writing about was of a certain period in the war, yeah. I carried the story, the broad history of the war through the whole book.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I asked you about cabin conditions in your airplanes when you're flying over the Himalayas.
Oh, yeah. cold, cold and windy. Those airplanes were great, but they, you know, the windows didn't fit, and there was always something going wrong. And if you'll notice on one of the pages on the book, there's a huge hose hanging down from the ceiling is right beside me, and that was a heater hose for the main cabin. And if you got really cold, you could take one of those hoses and shove it down inside your collar, and that hot air made it palatable for you to be there. But your feet got cold, the rain came in, it was not a bed of roses. It was not like your Boeing 767.
No, not the pressurized cabins of today.
Oh, no. No, we were on oxygen.
You had to be, or else you wouldn't have been able to breathe. And how cold were the temperatures? Are we talking about 70, 80 below?
Oh, no. I don't know. I know it was cold enough so my feet froze up almost permanently. No, it was just, I don't think it was that bad for that long a time. I would call it damn uncomfortable.
All right. And you mentioned sticking the heater hose inside your jacket. Now, I understand one of your flight jackets got some use in a more recent American war.
Yes. Yeah. Proud to say that my granddaughter was, there were two girls. My wife and I helped with raising both of them. We spent a lot of time with them. Jenny, the one that of which I'll speak mostly, was the kind of a kid that would drive you crazy. She made our life miserable and did everything wrong, didn't know what to do with herself until my wife told her one day, you're going to do something with your life and I'm going to get you started. And she went out to the Navy recruitment office and said, hey, I got an intolerable kid at home that needs some help. Can I bring her out here? And they said, no. We'll come see her. So a couple of guys from the Navy recruiting office came out and talked to her, said that she might be able to get in the Navy if she got a GED. She didn't even have her high school diploma. So she thought it over and thought it over. They took her to San Jose for testing. She was very bright, totally bright. And she passed the test, I think, higher than anybody they'd experienced in this recruiting office. So she was on her way, and she got her GED. I took her out to Pacific Grove for a month or so every day so she could finish up her GED. After boot camp, she went to the Navy Language School, learned Russian and Farsi both, and acted as an interpreter for the military. And then she went overseas, I guess because of the fact that I'd been flying. She volunteered to become an aircrew member, also a spook listener, you know. I think she picked up about 800 or 1,000 hours of combat flight time, but she decided that she didn't want to stay in the Navy because she was going to have a baby and she didn't want to be deployed again. Anyhow, she went on to take the same kind of job that she'd had in the Navy with a private company, and that's what she's doing now for NSA, National Security Agency.
Are you allowed to tell me that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But so when was it that she wore your World War II flight jacket?
That was when she was flying in the P-2Vs, when she was on her session in Afghanistan and Iraq.
So she's flying in Afghanistan and Iraq with the Navy in surveillance missions.
Right.
But she's wearing the same jacket that you wore flying over the hump 70 years ago.
That's right. Absolutely.
Gotta love it.
A2 jacket.
Outstanding. And that's not the only more recent twist. I'm guessing it's not in your book, the adventure that you had just in the last 6 months or so at the Salinas Air Show, which is a popular event every year in Salinas, California, not too far from here where you live in Santa Cruz. You got to go up in the plane that you used to train guys in?
That was one of the great things that's happened to me in my life. I can never thank those people down there enough. Dave Prestes was the pilot that took me up. Just a marvelous guy. Flies P-51s and flew this T-6. I called down there to see if it were possible to purchase rides on military aircraft. I mentioned the fact that I was a World War II pilot and wanted to take a ride. And they made it available. They called and said, well, you're not paying for any ride. We're going to give you a ride in this T-6. And I thought, oh, man, just a dream come true, which it was. The television people down there and the people that were running the air show, and Dave has become a friend, the guy that flew me in the T-6, Everybody was just so great to me. I can't tell you, it was one of the best days of my life, and I told them that. I want to say this, as a veteran of a war 70 years ago, 91 years old, the care that I've received from my local Veterans Administration has been unexcelled. I have a Dr. Mary Roberts down at Fort Ord that has given me as high quality physical treatment as any doctor I've ever experienced. And I have to say that because I hear so much. I know there's probably some shortcomings. But when you figure that this country, after 70 years, still remembers and compensates veterans for their service, taking care of their health needs, their mental needs, I think it's miraculous. There's no other country in the world that treats their veterans like this country does. And I'm so deeply grateful for that.
Well, you say that, how grateful you are. And, well, the point is, we're grateful for you and all those guys like you. And I don't want to forget to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for writing a book about it so we could understand what really went on and what it was all about. When you think back now on all these experiences, what are you most thankful for and what are you most proud of?
Without question, I'm most proud of my service. I'm most proud of the fact that as a little child, I was introduced to a phenomenal capability, the capability of flight, and that through all the years, I was able to maintain an intense interest in that. People have been kind to me ever since I've lost a great deal of my sight. People have taken me up on flights. I've been treated like a king. And through it all, the capability to fly an airplane, a military aircraft, particularly when I was flying single engine, transcends any other happenstances other than my marriage, of course, and the love of my children and all that. It's right up there with the top. I can remember when I was flying T-6s, I used to look out from side to side and see, I'm up here and I'm flying this thing. It could have guns on it if it needed them and all this. And this is the greatest moment of my life. And it was.
One last thought on your recent T-6 adventure here in Salinas. I've been up in one of those T-6s, and what I remember is the pilot has the ability, if he wants to let you fly the airplane from that back seat.
They let me fly.
They
put the stick in the back seat and let me fly the airplane. Now, I didn't do a very good job of it because I don't see much anymore.
You're literally flying blind? Is that what you're saying?
Flying blind in the true sense of the word. And Dave and I laughed about it, that I kept losing and gaining altitude, which I never would have done if I'd been able to see, because he said, well, you haven't forgotten anything, which was a kindness that he didn't have to say, but was deeply appreciated.
Did you feel like you were 20 years old again?
When I sat down in that airplane, I felt like I'd never left it. Everything was where it was supposed to be. The instrument panel was fogged, but I knew what was where, and I knew where the throttle was, the mixture control, the prop control. I told them, and it chokes me up a little bit now, it was like going home.
Well, I guess the only other question on that I have is, now that you've checked that box on the T-6, is there an airplane out there that you've always wanted to get in that you still haven't?
P-51. That's in my bucket list. At 91, I hope the opportunity will present itself sometime so that I could take a flight in a P-51. It's a dream, but I've already had one magnificent dream fulfilled, and that was a flight in the T-6. So I don't know if you ever have a right to ask for another one. You know?
No, but other people have the right to bless you with it if they so desire.
Well, that's wonderful, yeah. I'm just grateful for all of the kindness that has been extended to me, and that's the payment. Only payment that I really needed and wanted for the time I put in. I've been thanked a million times.
Well, I'm glad you were up for hearing it one more time from us today. That's Ed Larson. Check out his book, some of his artwork, and the photos at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find a little bonus audio with Ed that didn't quite fit into our show today. We are out of time, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.